And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 5 minutes past nine on this Wednesday. It's the 17th of April, 2024. You're very welcome along to the show. And it's still the busy 3 hours, as you've come to expect now, don't you? Plenty of news, plenty of features and conversation and a bit of crack as well along the way. 086 60 25,000, the WhatsApps and text number for you open right now. And if you want to send in your voice notes, of course, to WhatsApp, it's the same number there. If you want to give us a call, it's 07491 25,000, and emails from wherever you're listening to comments@highlandradio.com. Right, let's have a quick glance through what's making some of the headlines on the newspapers this morning, starting with the Finn Valley Voice. They've got further coverage of views of Dickie Hearlock of Donegal County Council, Martin Harley. Concerns were expressed at the recent Lifford Stranraer Municipal District meeting at County House in Lifford that the Return Recycling Initiative was brought in far too soon and would harm small businesses. Councillor Martin Harley, Cathaoirleach of the Council, says that a large number of businesses and customers don't know how to use the scheme and that small businesses are at risk. On to the Nationals now. And the Irish Times, timing is everything, and the government, by accident or design, is delaying or won't be getting to quite a number of measures that are planned until after the local elections. Amongst them, ministers are set to discuss a new options paper for abortion reform, but senior government sources have warned that further change is unlikely before the next general election. Last April, Barrister Marie O'Shea submitted a review to government on the adequacy of the state's abortion laws. The review recommended the decriminalisation of doctors, the removal of the mandatory 3-day waiting period to access termination medication, and the introduction of a statutory obligation on healthcare workers to refrain from providing misleading information. Her review also found that there is a lack of clarity around allowing abortion in the case of fatal fetal abnormality. Taoiseach Simon Harris has now rejected claims he is sitting on his hands in relation to reforms of abortion services, given the report has been with government for a year. The accusation came in the Dáil as Social Democrats leader Holly Cairns and People Before Profit TD Breed Smith highlighted the RTE investigation documentary on abortion services, in which a number of women shared their personal stories and were traumatised, significantly stigmatised and penalised. Now, I didn't see that show, but I did note some of the reaction to it seemed to be that people were expected two sides of the argument and didn't get it in relation to that, one of the most polarising issues in the country. TV licence inspectors given resilience training to cope with abuse on the doorstep, according to the Irish Independent. OnPost was forced to stop TV licence inspections and offer resilience training to staff because of public anger over the RTE payment scandal. A spokesperson said increased hostility, mainly in the form of verbal abuse, led OnPost to take action to protect its workers. A union representing TV licence inspectors claimed their lives had become almost impossible since a political party allegedly signalled permission for non-payment of the fee. The OnPost spokesperson said the level of aggression and abuse experienced on doorsteps was sufficient to cause concerns among staff. A resilience training was introduced and an external expert guided inspectors through potential real-life situations and how to deal with challenging scenarios. Full inspections, including house-to-house calls, have since been removed. So clearly then that resilience training is working, or public anger has eased off. The Irish Daily Mail has a report on how illegal immigrants are slipping into Ireland with fake travel packages. Gangs are acting as criminal travel agents by selling packages of fake documents to allow illegal migration into Ireland. Criminals have been targeting Georgian nationals who wish to claim asylum in Ireland by producing fake driving licenses and identification cards from EU countries. These are then posted to asylum seekers to allow them to travel to Ireland. The Irish Daily Mail understands that such packages can sell for anywhere between 8 and 12,000 euro on the black market. Internal government documents obtained by the Irish Daily Mail raised concerns over an increasing number of asylum claims made by Georgian citizens in Ireland in recent years. Sources said many of these people are arriving here with fake work permits or visas, some of which could be EU documents or fake Irish work permits. And the paper concludes that many Georgians are coming just to improve their financial lots. On to the Irish Daily Star now, and there is going to be some innovation in terms of cameras, detection cameras, driving detection cameras. In the first instance, though, not many of them, but the technology apparently is going to show if you've got your phone on your lap. Technology to detect people driving with no seatbelt or while on their mobile phone will only be available on 9 road cameras, the Justice Minister said yesterday. A meeting on Monday evening held by Taoiseach Simon Harris, senior ministers, including McEntee, and the Road Safety Authority agreed several new measures. These included work to resolve technical and legal issues so enforcement cameras can identify mobile phone use and seatbelt wearing as offences. Asked by the Star when this technology would be rolled out and how many cameras would be affected, Ms. McEntee indicated that it would only apply to 9 static cameras that will be installed across the country. That's work being done by the Department of Transport, and obviously the sooner the better. So in terms of, you know, oh, we must do something, something's announced, and then, as usual, it takes a lifetime to be introduced if it ever is. Ireland is third in the world for the number of bars per head, did you know? We've retained that position, according to the Irish Daily Mirror. Ireland still ranks third highest in the world for the number of pubs per head, despite recent record closures. But what's happening is too as well. Well, we'll get to that as we read through the article. The figures from a new health report also show that people aged 15 years and over in the country in 2023 drank 9.9... Sorry, is that 9? I can't see if there's a dot there. I don't think there is. 9.9 litres of pure alcohol a year. It is 9.9. The dot appeared before my very eyes. That's the equivalent of 37 bottles of vodka, 104 bottles of wine, or 400 pints of beer every single year, apparently. The study from the Health Research Board, which is published today, warned that alcohol is still Ireland's number one substance abuse. The Irish Mirror reported last August that almost 2,000 pubs have closed nationwide since 2005. A HRB spokesperson said, despite a decline in pubs, Ireland still ranks third highest in the world for the number of pubs per head. But what's happening is the licence now being transferred to off-licences, aren't they? So you've got an off-licence every which way you look, and much fewer pubs. That being said, perhaps we had too many pubs. If you're a boxing fan and if you have Netflix, you're in for a treat, because she's taking on Serrano again, and it's going to be free to those who have Netflix. Boxing's Katie Taylor, her rematch against Amanda Serrano will be shown for free on Netflix. My concern here is I actually don't think Katie's going to win that fight, and I think her swan song potentially is going to be on a streaming platform and not top of the bill, which is fine. It's a big money fight for her, but perhaps not. She might not go out after that fight, but my suspicion is she possibly will. She's in against a very powerful boxer who will want to avenge their first fight. The Bray Bomber, 37, will take on the Puerto Rican, 35, in Dallas, Texas on July 20th. It comes 2 years after Katie defeated Serrano at New York's Madison Square Garden in a brutal fight, it was. Katie yesterday said, "This is the rematch the world has wanted to see. The first fight in New York was obviously an epic occasion, and it more than lived up to the billing, and I'm sure the rematch will be no different." Okay, it's interesting. And there's another major fight this weekend, again for fight fans if you're interested. Ryan Garcia features in it. He's a bit of a poster boy for boxing, but anyone who follows him on social media would see that either he's an incredible play actor or he is he's suffering with his mental health, and unfortunately, rather than maybe to see if he needs supports or what have you, his mental health difficulties, which seem apparent and are being talked about broadly in the fight game, are actually being used to market the fight. Is he, you know, is he just mad or will he get mad? You know, that kind of stuff, which is really quite unfortunate in this day and age. But anyway, 0866 20 5000 WhatsApps and texts to that number. Now, according to a recent release, Donegal County Council has paid over or made payments in total of €23.8 million as part of the Enhanced Effective Concrete Blocks Grant Scheme, as it's officially called. To break this down and go through some of these figures, we're joined by Michael McGarvey, who's Director of Water Environment with responsibility for the private Enhanced Defective Block Grant Scheme. Good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning, Greg.
Thanks for joining us. Right, so the most recent tranche of payments totals just over €1 million, and it's to 15 approved applicants under the Defective Concrete Block Scheme in recent days. Are we starting to see a bit of movement at a pace that's more agreeable now?
Yes, we are, Greg, and it's something that we first of all would acknowledge from the council would acknowledge that the homeowners out there, you know, they're going through a lot, and what we want to try and do is obviously ease that as much as possible, trying to process these payments. So we have made reasonable progress now in the past number of months in particular, and we hope to continue to do that, to streamline that, shorten the timelines and make it as easy as possible for the homeowners.
Also, quite a number of ancillary grant applications being paid out. What are they for?
Basically, the ancillary grants, that's where it's available to homeowners where they've incurred costs where they've had to seek alternative accommodation. And that can be done for two reasons, where their current dwelling is at risk or is no longer habitable due to damage. Caused by the defective concrete blocks, or secondly, where alternative accommodation then, where during the remediation of their home that they've got to seek alternative accommodation. So there's 15,000 15,000 maximum grant available for accommodation there for those homeowners, and that's covered under that ancillary grant. And secondly, where there's storage costs that they incur, storage costs for the contents of their dwelling, that there's a maximum available there for 5,000. So they're the two ancillary grants, mm-hmm. and we are seeing now applicants applying for those. We're going through, some of those have been processed and be paid now, have been approved payment, and there's more of them. We've sought information.
Well, just in relation to that, you received 23 ancillary grant applications, but the council has had to make contact with 20 of those, the absolute majority, a great majority of them, in relation to outstanding information required to validate their grant application. What is going on there? Is it a difficulty in people knowing what to provide to the council in the first instance, or why are you having to seek so much additional information for so many applicants?
Well, I suppose because it's the first time that a lot of the homeowners have actually made the application, and that we've helped walk them through this here and get the information that's required. Obviously, due to any public spending, we've got to make sure that, you know, that it's transparent, accountable. But a lot of those homeowners that we have contacted have submitted the information, and we've approved those, and that the payments will be what those next week. And we really hope that in the coming weeks that all that will be cleared up, and the learning from that, we, you know, will make information available on our portal, on our website, to actually try and make it easier. People are clear, and we are getting messages out there to all homeowners exactly what's required. So when we receive them, we just want to be able to pay them. There has been some short delays here at this, not delays, but for information required, and we hope that that will be streamlined in the coming weeks.
So how many live applications off the top of your head are with the council at the moment?
Yeah, we're talking about over 50, but as I say there, that we've processed, there's 15 approved this week. We have the 23 ancillary payments, and there's 6 of those have been approved this week. And I think the majority of those will be paid mm-hmm. next week and the following week. So, they are being processed, and they are, we are finding that people are able to put them in. Some people are getting paid, within 2 days, or the payments can be approved within 2 days where the information is correct. And that's what we hope to get it down for the rest of the people as well.
So just to be clear, in total, not just ancillary grants, but as part of the whole scheme, actively, how many are in the process of working through the scheme at the point whereby, you know, they're getting testing done, or they're they're progressing through the scheme? It's greater than 50, is it?
Yeah. Oh, it is indeed, yeah. Like, as when the new scheme was announced last July, that we had received, the council had received 1,249, I think it was, in total. All of those, 849 had been approved, where one option or another had been determined. The others were passed then on to the housing agency, and they've processed quite a few of those, and I can just run through. So look, at the minute, what I would say is, works have been completed in 43 homes. There's works ongoing on the ground and construction works in another 100 homes. We've received 78 notices of commencement, and total of grants have been decided is over 500. I think it's 510 or 512 grants have been decided. You know, so there's quite a few in the system, and we are finding that that's continuing to ramp up in recent weeks.
At the level you'd expect, Michael, and that you're staffed
for? Well, in some cases, look, I suppose there's learning for all of us here, and we found that for people have applied for the to be considered under the scheme, when they've been told that they are being and have been told that they have been approved for a certain option, some people are deciding to wait until, like, the house may have, you know, it's been proven that there's defective concrete blocks issues there, but they've decided to wait for a period of time. In some cases where their families or their kids may be at a younger age, and they're waiting until maybe that they've gone to college or whatever it is, so that even their alternative accommodation works, etc., or accommodation needs might be different. So we are finding that different people have different needs. Some people, obviously, we've heard over the last few years, people in terrible circumstances where they're living in concern and in fear. And those are the people, obviously, who have moved earlier. And some people then, for peace of mind, just wanted to move. But there's some people that may not move as quickly.
So if someone, say, for instance, someone now were to get the test and to be accepted onto the scheme, and the house is showing signs of cracks, okay, but sort of hasn't deteriorated beyond that, or the process is ongoing, can they still move through the scheme as well, or does the property have to be at a certain state or condition before work can progress?
No, it's more streamlined now. There was quite, as it was not onerous, but there was quite a detailed piece of work needed where engineers had to come in and carry out examples, core samples, and they had to be submitted and assessed, etc. That was under the old scheme. Under the new scheme now, the housing agency, basically, first of all, a homeowner who has concerns, they can employ an engineer, competent building professional, who can come out and carry out building condition assessment. And that's actually a relatively, it's not a simple, but it's a relatively lot less onerous. It's something that costs in the terms of hundreds rather than in multiples of thousands. They submit that, and that's basically a visual inspection where there's visible cracks, etc. And that's what the housing agents consider. They have a turnaround time, I think it's 90 working days, to come back that, yes, you've met the threshold or not. The homeowner's informed. And then there's more detailed assessment needed by the housing agency with taking samples, etc. But in terms of people who have concerns out there at the moment, I think it is important that they would actually, you know, consider contacting engineers, competent building professionals, carry out initial assessment, and they can get peace of mind relatively quickly.
And currently, in terms of approvals, it's all remedial options, is it? So elderly, full demolitions, we're still approving the scheme in those terms, are we?
That's right, yeah. There's five options, options one to five. Option one is the entire dwelling has been approved to be demolished and rebuilt in the same position. And then option two is where the external walls, option two and option three is external walls are rebuilt. And option then there's option four then where the external walls down to the top of the rising wall, and that's just the external wall. And then there's an option five there as well. The outer leaf only is affected.
Okay.
There's the option. So they're still being assessed. The same options have been assessed, yeah.
And at this stage, obviously, we can't consider the likes of foundations because the science hasn't been agreed on that unofficial, in an official capacity just yet.
No, that there remains the same as it was. And again, the regulations and the guidelines do talk about if that if there's something that emerges to change, but there's a clear position at the minute that that is excluded at the moment.
Okie doke. And in terms then, is it in the council's gift then, once a house has been sort of remediated in options 2 to 5, that sort of allows the homeowner to get insurance? Is that a role with the council, house insurance? Has that been resolved at all, or is that a different department?
Well, the department established as an implementation steering group, and they have been meeting regularly, I think monthly, since last July. But they've also set up a subgroup, got the Engineers Ireland, they've got the insurance companies and the banks, and they have been meeting since, I think it's December, on a monthly basis again. And they have well advanced and expect an announcement to be made in the coming weeks or months just on the whole insurability, because the message coming from that, it will be very clear that there will be insurable and mortgageable, etc. So that's something that is not yet released, but we expect that in the coming weeks or months.
Okay, Michael, thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye, take care. Michael McGarvey there, Director of Water and Environment with responsibility for the Private Enhanced Effective Block Grant Scheme. Obviously, some of those questions, it might be seen as, common knowledge and what have you. But I think sometimes the thing with this crisis, this scandal, is that there are new people discovering all the time that they are or may well be affected by it. So I think it's good sometimes just to ask the more obvious questions again for the benefit of those people. Right, we're joined on the programme now by Michael Harrison, former Garda traffic inspector. Michael, thank you so much for your time this morning.
How are you, Greg? Thanks very much.
No, it's good. Good to have you. Thanks for accepting our invite. We want to talk about road safety, and there's some specifics in terms of detections and also this ridiculous situation where we found that collision data was not being shared. The government committing to do something about that, but still, I want to talk to you a little about that. But, you know, over the years, Michael, speaking to you and your colleagues, the messaging has always remained the same. And you know, when it worked, you'd be somewhat encouraged. But then we saw an upward trend again, I think, really, in terms of, you know, fatal road traffic collisions, very serious life-changing injuries and detections for drink and drug driving in the basics, like, you know, speeding and non-wearing of seatbelts. I mean, you reflected all the while, and I'm sure you still do. What's going wrong in this country? Once we were held up, and not too long ago, as a great example in Europe at what can be achieved, and we seem to have been regressing every year since.
There's been a number of things. It's just not one aspect, Greg. And like, I know when I was working, I was on Highland several times, and since I retired, Caroline has asked me on numerous occasions to go on and speak about road safety, and I've refused on every single occasion because it was behind me. It was something that, you know, that I'd done, and I had it done. But it's only in the last few months, this particularly in the start of this year and last year, you see the steady increase in road deaths, and it's been absolutely crazy. And then I watched the primetime program last week, and I was aware. The issue with regard to the non-sharing of data, you know, of collision data, I was aware of that when I was retiring, that was coming up. And to see 4 years down the road, absolutely nothing has happened. You know, this is I give you an example how important that is. Like, there's, if you take road safety, there's three pillars of road safety. You have education, you have enforcement, and you have engineering. Now, we know through the because of the numbers in the Gardaí, their numbers have dropped, so they can't commit as much. So we know enforcement has dropped. So the enforcement pillar has been weakened. But you remove the engineering pillar completely, well, that is certainly going to increase. And an example here in this county, Donegal County Council was one of the most proactive councils. When I worked with them, they were really proactive. And we used to meet every single month, and then you'd meet with all the local engineers around the county 3 or 4 times a year. And they would have the data given to them where the collisions were happening. They would analyse that data, and they would look then from local input from the local Gardaí about what is the best way to address. It could be sight lines at a junction, it could be moving line markings, it could be introducing more signs, traffic calming measures, whatever it needs to be.
Kind of stuff that we necessarily as motorists didn't know precisely what was going on.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? There'd just be a cones out for a couple of weeks. Yeah. Something would have changed marginally, but that would have been a local authority reaction to data available to it from Ongar Tiakana.
Exactly, and that data was given to them by the RSA. But whatever, and if you take that out of it altogether, so if the road safety engineers in a county are operating blindly, if they're not getting the data, like they're getting some data from TII, but that's only on the national primary routes, but they're getting absolutely nothing regarding the regional routes where most of our collisions happen. And if you remove that out of it, it's really, really worrying. And we did take our ball, you know, during the pandemic, the road deaths went down substantially, but they have been increasing steadily since. And it's the impact it has on families. It's the devastating impact it has on families. And you see, you know, when I went in and looked and started researching, and you see that absolutely nothing has changed, like even driving license data, like 94% of learner drivers don't surrender their licenses after they're convicted in court. 85% of ordinary drivers don't surrender their license in court.
What is the consequence of that? I mean, that is terrible, okay? But if those people are determined to drive, would they not drive anyway? You know, if they roll up, like, they're not going to be detective with or without the license because there aren't any checkpoints to sort of flag it.
Well, there are some checkpoints, and the guard they do have. I have been stopped, and I have to say, in the last few weeks, I've been stopped three times in the last few weeks in this county. Mm. I have noticed an increase in checkpoints. I have noticed them using the devices, but if the guards don't have access, if you don't produce your, I'll explain it. If you don't produce your license in court, the Department of Transport can't associate the conviction with your driving license number. So what they do is they create a ghost record. So if Michael Harrison is convicted for drink driving in court, I don't produce my license in court. The Department of Transport, they know Michael Harrison has been convicted, but they don't know my driving license number. So they create a ghost record. So there's two Michael Harrisons with two license numbers on the file. So the file is incomplete. Mm. So it can't shared. And that, you know, that is worrying for, you know, for our police force that's out there that, you know, that is trying to stop disqualified.
Well, one hand is tied behind the back, clearly, because there's conflicting information. You could describe it. What I've asked this question numerous times, and I've never really been satisfied with the answer. And it's not because of the person that's offering all the answer. It's just, how do so many people, like over 9 out of 10 people in the case of some, and 8 out of 10 people in the case of others, know after being told to surrender their license in court that they don't have to and they can get away with it. They can just hold on to it. Some it'll be for ID or whatever. But I never can understand how so many people know that they don't have to hand this documentation in after a really quite serious conviction, and just simply don't do it.
Because there's no consequences for them.
But
not
how
doing.
Do they know that? Are they being advised by their legal professionals, or
not having been in that situation? Yeah. I've been in court and I've heard judges giving the warning and court clerk and the court registrar giving the warning for the licenses. But the statistics are there,
and then they get a letter and they disregard that as well.
Yeah. Because they don't want the conviction recorded against their driving license number. And the system has to change. The system
They must be getting that legal advice, though. They have to be, because I can't understand how the 9 out of 10 people know that you can disregard what the judge says and you can disregard what the letter says.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that, Greg. I don't have first-hand information on that, but mm-hmm. they must be getting the information. As you say, I would agree with you. I won't disagree with you.
And another thing that I can't, like, I, when we're talking about road traffic collisions and road safety, on this occasion, on many occasions, I've talked about the roads and the engineering, and I never put it quite as well as you did in terms of the pillars, but I've always tried to highlight that. And all the while, ignorantly, I and the majority of the population didn't realise that since 2018, this vital data wasn't being made available to engineers. And GDPR was the excuse being used. Well, it's not an excuse. It was the reason being given. I mean, that hopefully that changes now. But like,
well, it's lingering on. It's just not with road safety. You know, GDPR is an issue. And I honestly think people are hiding behind it. People are hiding behind GDPR in this country. It's like, it's the same legislation right across Europe. How are other countries able to get over this hurdle of GDPR? Another situation is Tuusula make a referral on child abuse to the Garda Síochána. If the Garda Síochána want to get in-depth information, GDPR prevents it, and they have to get a warrant. Like, that's been in existence for absolute years, and nobody's done anything to fix it. And I can't understand for the life of me, you know, organizations are risk assessing the GDPR. The fines are so high, and the risk assessing the facts of receiving information. And I honestly think that if there's one red flag, it might be that the chances of them being referred to the Data Commissioner might be absolutely minuscule. But if they get one red flag, they stop it. No, we don't want that data. And if other countries in Europe are able to, particularly in Sweden and Germany, other countries are able to exchange this data on road safety, vital information on road safety, I cannot understand why GDPR has become such a huge hurdle in this country. I just don't understand it. I think the Data Commissioner is going to have to be more proactive in encouraging organisations, in education organisations, the legal advice that's been given to some of the, you know, to some groups. You know, how robust is it? Are they testing it out? It is a worry. Like I know when I studied GDPR, the Data Commissioner's advice, and that we're only here to give guidance. But, you know, they should be able to give firm directions and assistance, you know, to people so that this data can be freely available. Like road collision data is given anonymously. There's no names, there's no numbers. Whether it was the fact that there was that remote possibility of linking stuff on social media to that data, and that could create...
But that nut has been cracked in other parts of Europe, so yeah. there's no excuse, really. Someone here is dropping the ball.
No, it's laziness. It's laziness on a number of things, and I'm just wondered, does the Department of Transport, you know, possess the skill set to deal with these issues? You know, there was, you know, after the economic crash, there was a dumb, you know, the public servants, you know, were treated appallingly. You know, the way the wages were cut, and we have seen that now. We have nurses, teachers, and members of the force, where they're leaving, you know, where they are leaving in quite high numbers, and I've no doubt it's the same in the public service. And it is getting that, you know, that skill set, that intelligence back into our organisations, so that we can deal with basic problems like GDPR. There seems to be a lack of confidence or a lack of willingness to deal with it.
And the problem is that on the face of it, Drew Harris announcing that every Garda will do half an hour, is it a week or per shift of high visibility enforcement. When we hear that the Garda don't have access to driving licence data and the other issues, it sounds like we're doing something. But we have to be honest with ourselves. And I'll say it again, those Garda are going out with one arm tied behind their back.
Yeah, well, I don't want to comment too much on it. Any enforcement is certainly welcome, you know, enforcement, any extra increase in enforcement. But the night, you know, to mention it on the night that the primetime programme was going out, it was a wee bit weird. You know, why mention it? Why wasn't that mentioned? Like our road collision, were up 20% last year, all through the year. You had this steady increase in road traffic collisions. And there is, the night that it's mentioned is the night the prime time program, and it's just like the road, the roads units are down in numbers. And you take it mightn't seem a lot, but you say there might be one county might be short four members, but that four members means that every week you have 40 hours where there's no policing happening on those roads in that 40 hours, because that's one unit. So that's one unit where there's no shift. And that's over the year, then that's over 2,000 hours where there's no roads policing happening in that area. And that's just on four members. And you multiply that right throughout the force and see how many numbers the roads policing unit is down nationally. And is it any wonder our road debts are gone up?
One of the other solutions is to pump millions into the Road Safety Authority on education.
Well, the Department of Transport last year, whenever the road deaths were going up, they went to the Road Safety Authority and they asked the Road Safety Authority, do you need any extra funding? And this was documented in the Irish Times earlier this year. Yeah, on the 30th of January, it was in the Irish Times, and Sam Wade, they put in a submission, and they were looking for 600 million for extra staff, you know, so that they could shorten the driving license waiting line, and the Department of Transport refused them. So, you know, back in November, October, they asked them, the RSA, for suggestions. Do you need any extra funding? Come the January 2024, they refused them the money. So it's, you know, there is this willingness to deal with road safety. And I honestly don't think when you see all the issues that exist, that have existed, I'm retired now nearly 4 years, and those problems are still there. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely, you know, it's distressing. It's distressing for the families out there that are losing, that are losing.
And I think why you've sort of opted to speak, I can't presume why, but obviously to help highlight this ridiculous situation of the non-sharing of information. But you know firsthand, you know firsthand exactly what every single road traffic collision fatality means to a family, because you've seen that. The worst news ever to be delivered to someone. And much of it is avoidable. So I think that's a great deal of the reason why you're so passionate about this still, Michael, even as you sort of try and move forward with your retirement.
Yeah, it is. It is that, you know, when you see, you know, when you work with dedicated people from Donegal County Council, road safety engineers, road safety officers, the different roads, and you see the dedication and the work, you know, that was done in this county in making the roads safer, and then you find out, oh my God, they're still having that problem fixed 4 years down the road. Is it any wonder? And it is, the engineering aspect is a very, very important pillar of road safety that's recognised right throughout the planet.
Michael Harrison, former Gala traffic inspector, thank you for your time.
Thanks very much, Greg.
All right. Susan Gray, founder of Promoting Awareness, Responsibility and Care, a.k.a. PARC, joins us on the programme now. Susan, interesting comments. I'm not sure how much of Michael Harrison's contribution you got to listen to there, but, I mean, he's been at the coalface and he sort of tries to avoid commenting on these things because, you know, it's part of his previous life, but feels he needs to speak out now to try and help highlight the inadequacies of just the system.
Yes, good morning, Greg, and we want to thank Michael Harrison. That was one of the best interviews I've heard on road safety for a long time. Michael said it as it is, and we have so many issues out there, and they're still being dealt with 4 or 5 years down the line. They still haven't completed their tasks to make our roads safer.
When we talk about staffing as well, Susan, you know, and we talk about new recruits coming in to the Gardaí and all that kind of stuff, I mean, we do have to be parochial on this and say, right, growing the Gardaí is fine on a national basis, but how many guards are coming to Donegal? Our roads policing unit at the moment is down to 22. And Michael really put it in black and white what that means. The loss of hours in terms of road safety enforcement, it's really quite stark for us here in Donegal. Not surprising so few people have penalty points compared to other counties.
Yes. Michael, I can't believe how well he put it. Everybody will understand it when it's coming from Michael Harrison, plain English. Now, the Garda spokesperson gave a comment to the Irish Times there a few weeks ago about roads policing. And they said, roads policing is a specialist area and replacement members are appointed to this crucial role on the basis of internal competition only. Proposals are in an advanced stage to commence an internal competition for roads policing units in the near future, Greg. So we know that Paula Hillman, the Assistant Commissioner for Roads Policing, gave a statement to Primetime last Thursday saying that she aims to have another 75 members in roads policing by the end of this year. We know from the Garda statement that I've just read out, this will not happen unless competitions start in each region, and any Garda that's interested in moving and joining roads policing has to apply. Mm-hmm. A list is sent to Garda headquarters. A panel has to be set up for interviews. Successful candidates are informed. Then they have to go for training. You're talking about months and months. Mm-hmm. And there's PQs been raised for us now today and hopefully discussed in the Doyle as well.
Yeah, and words
how
are
many
good.
Competitions have started.
Which is, you know, it's going to be very few, Susan. I mean, that's the unfortunate reality of it. What about the argument is that, right, okay, of course it's good to have specific Gardaí working in road policing, but all Gardaí at some point or other, and they'll actually be mandated to now, are involved in road policing. It's, you know, we could, I think really the point that they were trying to make, I think it might have been Drew Harris or one of his, or one of his support people that work for him, suggesting that, look,
all the policing is not done by the roads policing, and that doesn't tell the full picture because all of the Gardaí on the front line are involved in policing the roads.
But Michael explained about the 30 minutes per shift.
40, yeah.
You know, it's not going to make
much of a difference.
Yeah, I got you. We cannot. In 2009, we had over 1,000 members in roads policing. We're down to just over 600 now. In the last 2 years, we lost something like 110. This is not right, Greg, whatever way you look at it. We need these valuable members in roads policing. We do. And it is welcome that we're going to get more maybe by the end of the year. But we need to push. We need the media to push for these, for details of these competitions, when they're starting, when they're finished, and when we're going to see these 75. Yeah.
Like, I know the media has a role, don't get me wrong, and we stand up to that role. But there's almost 200 people getting over 100 grand a week in the dole that could get their finger out as well, Susan. Mm. You know, they are being paid very, very well by the people of this country. And part of that is to actually, you know, legislate and make life better and safer for people. And I certainly wouldn't give those 170-odd people a pass in relation to this as well. What else are they doing?
Oh, I know, Greg, you're so right. But the reality of the situation, if it wasn't for prime time highlighting this, it is very, very, I don't know what word to use, but the Garda Commissioner came out just hours before prime time was due to be aired to say now every Garda has to do 30 minutes of their shift on roads policing. It's no coincidence that Paula Hillman went on prime time and said by the end of the year, she aims to have another 75. That was prime time. Have no doubt about it. And we fear that when the media lose track of this or they die down on their reporting of it, that things may, business may go back to normal. That's the way it works in the Dáil. He who cries the loudest gets things done. But once that problem dies down and it's not reported very well and often, the problem, they go on to another problem that's been highlighted, and we don't want to see that happening.
Okay.
Now, Greg, can I just talk about that disqualified drivers? I heard Michael speaking on them, right? Not surrendering their license. And you asked him, how do these people know that they don't have to surrender their license and they'll be undetectable? When they don't give their license number in court, they're supposed to be written out to them after 14 days by the RSA or the courts to tell them off the law saying they have to surrender their license, right? Or their learner permit. We don't believe that they're being written out to. Because as Michael said, if you don't surrender, if you don't give your license number in court, there could be two Michael Harrisons.
Yeah.
How do the officials know who to write out to tell them you have to, by law, surrender your license, and if you don't, you will be prosecuted? We believe the vast majority, and if it was to be true, 16,000 learners would have had to been written out to, and over 25,000 full Irish license holders would have to be written out to. We don't believe that letter has been sent out. We've asked and asked how many of these people have actually been sent out a letter. Mm. We've never got that
answer. They are being told in the courts. They are being told in the courts to surrender their license, and they're disregarding that. I can't imagine if they're being informed.
Oh, they're waiting on the letter. Have no doubt they're waiting on that letter.
No, I'm not quite sure.
And if I got a letter, I'd be more prone.
Yeah, but unless I was given information, if I went into a court and I had been done for drink driving, the judge says, by the way, you have to surrender your license, I probably naively now open my wallet, take my license out and say, there you are. But the majority, overwhelming majority of people know they don't have to do that. So I don't really think, to be honest with you, that people would heed a letter. But unfortunately, Susan, I have to... I do have to take a break here now, Susan. I do appreciate you coming on. We'll tease it out with you more, of course, in the future. That's Susan Gray, founder of Park. Caller says, with all respect to everyone who in government is listening to Highland this morning, you know the answer. It needs to be talked about on 2FM. Cork, who's listening in Cork FM? We don't have anyone here to do anything. That's completely not true, because we, through this programme and through you, the listeners, have... we have generated a great deal of change, not just locally but nationally as well. Issues that have been driven by this programme and its predecessor, it does have an impact on a national level. So I don't disagree with you, but there are far more people listening to a show like this than listen to many 2FM shows, even though it has a national moniker. And then the caller goes on to say, sure, Charlie McConnell will not come on to say hello. We're on our own in Donegal. Well, that's obviously related to the defective concrete block issue and the claim that I'm anti-government and all that kind of stuff. So, but anyway, sure, look, at that doesn't matter, actually. It doesn't matter. We're still making a difference here. Make no doubt about it. All right, we'll be back with more after the news and obituary notices.